This is Jim Inkster. Coming today, Smiley Anders, the Baton Rouge Advocate columnist for 34 years. He's with us to talk about many things that are happening, including his long tenure as a journalist, going back to the day John Kennedy was shot 50 years ago this Friday. Smiley, by the way, is celebrating his birthday with us. Also on the show, Dr. Sheldon Gottlieb, a Jewish activist who's not pleased with former President George Walker Bush, who last week spoke at a group that is designed to convert Jews to Christianity. And we will visit with Denise Bodie. She's at the Smart Growth Summit here in Baton Rouge, a nationally recognized energy policy expert, former corporate commissioner in Oklahoma. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, 297-5633, your local number. Outside our area, 877-217-5757, and Inkster Show at WRKF.org online. We begin with Smiley Gray Anders, Jr. For 34 years and counting, he's been writing a daily column in the Baton Rouge Advocate, and today he is celebrating his birthday, once again a tradition. Yes. On this program. Hi, Smiley.
Hi, Jim. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Doing well.
It's a great way to celebrate. I didn't get a cake or anything, but that's okay. Yeah, yeah.
Well, we'll work on that. 1937 in Natchez, Mississippi, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Before World War II, times were pretty tough at
they
that
were,
time.
Yeah. My folks didn't have a car. My dad had to borrow his brother's car to get me to the hospital. And it was sleeting and about to snow, and my mom always held that against me, you know, said it was a terrible day, and she had to get out in the cold and sleet to get to the hospital to birth me.
And how old were you when you moved to Baton Rouge?
I was eight. That was 20 years ago.
So you were eight right at the end of World War II.
Yeah, right.
So you must remember those early years.
Yeah, we had a my uncle and a cousin next door were both POWs during World War II. So I remember the anxiety. You know, I was a little kid, of course, but I remembered how upset everybody was and how they just hung on the any news about the war to see when it was going to be over. Of course, it was not over for several years after they were both airmen captured and in different camps in Germany.
Well, what a voyage it's been, starting in Natchez, Mississippi. In pre-World War II segregationist Deep South Mississippi.
It was solid.
Solid.
Yeah.
Militantly solid.
Oh, yeah, yeah. There was no such thing as integration. The word didn't even come into use in my experience until a good while later.
And here we are all these years later, and you're a resident of Spanish Town and considered to be, by those who know you, a moderate to left type person who grew up in a place at a time when you would think that somebody of your vintage and your heritage might be otherwise.
Yeah, well, I just I had a lot of good experiences with a lot of different people, learned a lot about the value of diversity and accepting everybody for what they are, and not how they look or anything else about them.
297-5633 if you'd like to talk with Smiley Anders on his birthday. I don't think you noted it in your column today, did you?
No, I didn't. I didn't.
Just wanted to be a low-key thing.
I didn't want anybody to know how old I was. Of course, you blew my cover there. Thanks a lot.
But 34 and a half years now writing a daily column. You may be one of, I would think, as far as daily columns, the longest standing or sitting columnist in America.
Yeah, I think Herb King did his in San Francisco for 50 something years, but he's of course deceased, so there might not be anyone else in the country.
Kane was the guy who inspired the guy who said, Smiley, this would be a good idea for you, right?
Yeah, we had an editor from San Diego, and they had a guy there who was doing a column, a daily items column, that was modeled on Herb Kane's up in San Francisco for the Chronicle. And he asked me to try. I had been doing business news, And he asked me to try it as an experiment just to see if it would work. The only instructions I got were that we'd like for to have people get their name in the Advocate without dying or holding up a convenience store.
By the way, I heard about something last night. I was unaware of this publication. There's something called the Baton Rouge Crime Report where you can read about all the people who've held up convenience stores or gotten DWIs or gotten in a fist fight or something. You were not in there, oh, Smiley okay. Anders. You were not in there. But you have been a staple in this community for a very long time. You grew up in this town. The only man I know of who went to high school with Billy Cannon and went to college with Rex Reed. Now, that's diversity.
That's quite a duo there.
Estruma High School.
Yeah. It's a great school.
Great school. One that we're talking about preservation often on this show, especially when Carolyn Bennett's here. What are they going to do with Estruma?
You know, I don't know. It's... It was always a neighborhood school, very much, tied to North Baton Rouge. Of course, the nature of North Baton Rouge changed. You had a lot of white flight out of there. And so the school, of course, is very different. But those of us who were there in kind of the glory days really, I think, got a real good education and prepared us well for, whatever was ahead.
And you went to LSU, as did... Mm-hmm. Billy Ab Cannon, who was born in the same year as you. Now you're younger than he is by a few months, but yet you graduated a year ahead of him, so you must have been a pretty bright guy.
Well, I did get out early. I started early because of my... But, damn. I got to learn to cut this thing off, I swear.
That's okay. Somebody's wishing you a happy birthday.
No, actually, CVS is calling. I have a prescription ready. I lead an exciting life, let me tell you.
Well, anyway, we were talking about Billy Cannon and you. Billy's born August 2nd of 37. You were born, obviously, November 20th of 37, and yet Billy's a smart guy.
I had one class with him, and we had a teacher who did not care if he was an athlete or who. She was just a kid in his class, and she was as rough on him as anybody else, and he did well. He made real good grades and, of course, did well, went to dental school and all that. So, I was a bright kid.
And we've talked about how your paths have intertwined and collided on the night of October 31, 1959. Smiley was on the field, and we discussed the fact that he was one of the first to report the 89-yard run by Billy Cannon to beat Ole Miss, the most famous play in LSU history. And Smiley called it as an 82-yard run.
I was a spotter for United Press International, which I'm sure some of your younger listeners haven't heard of, but it was a wire service that competed with Associated Press, and they hired students. I was a grad student at that time. They hired students to be spotters to go along with the photographer and take down who did what and how many yards, keep track of all that. And I was so excited because I was still an LSU. I mean, I was working, but I was still an LSU student and fan. And I got so excited I got it wrong. Luckily, it was corrected by the home office in Dallas. So the right information got out, and I didn't have to hang my head in shame.
Well, some may not be aware that Smiley was an accomplished journalist of many years before he started writing the column in 1979 when he would have been 41 years old. Yeah. And you in 1963, November 22nd, were 26 years old, fresh out of LSU a few years, and you were already working.
I was doing PR. Either for the Chamber of Commerce or Foreign Bureau, I'm not sure. 63 was probably Foreign Bureau, but I was driving in my car when I heard it on the radio.
And you went down to the old Chris's Bar?
I sure did, yeah.
That place, up until very recently, was still open.
Yeah, I don't think I even called in there or anything. I was so shocked, and I just went there and sat up at the bar, ordered a fish bowl of root beer, and sat there and watching TV, black and white TV, and then my friends just started drifting in. They had pretty much done the same thing, whatever they were doing. They just stopped it. We all, you know, wound up at Chris's and very, very quiet, just watching TV, seeing what happened, you know, as the events unfolded.
And when that afternoon, Smiley describes the fish bowls, that's exactly what the beer was served in. You could get a buzz going on one fish bowl.
Well, they were pretty big. You got a lot of. I really built up some muscles lifting those things too. They were quite hairy. So I considered it hydration and a workout lifting. So.
And there were probably more than a few fish bowls on this tragic day of. Served on this day, November 22nd, 1963, that afternoon. It was a Friday afternoon, as it will be this year.
We never...
And there was no happy hour that day.
No. There were probably half a dozen guys I knew who came in, did the same thing I did, just left work or didn't go back to work after lunch and just hung out there. That was the quietest afternoon I've ever had with those guys. We had... Nobody told any jokes or stories or anything. We just... kind of watched in shock. So,
how did that day change the course of history of this country?
Well, it the thing about it because of the national shock and when Lyndon Johnson came in, I think the way it happened, people were in such a mood for. I don't know, maybe to make up for it to the country that I think it helped the Civil Rights Bill get through because there was a lot of opposition. Matter of fact, my first thought was that it was segregationist because there was so much bitterness on that issue and Kennedy and his brother were blamed for so much of it. And so I think the national mood may not have been the same had he lived and stayed in office. But,
The former Governor Bob Kennan, didn't he campaign on an anti-Kennedy platform?
I'll never forget that cartoon. K.O. the Kennedys showed a guy with a boxing glove, which I guess was Kennan, and he was knocking over Jack and Bobby. And he was running for, I guess, governor again or something. But, you know, a full-page newspaper. Yeah, that ran... As I recall, it ran virtually the day of the assassination, within a week or so. I might be a little off on that, but I vividly recall the ad.
Well, for those who were not alive then or not aware, the kind of antipathy that we have, that some people have toward the current president, it was rivaled or surpassed. Kennedy was probably the most hated president of all time.
That's
most loved and hated.
Yeah, it really was. He was not as despised, I guess, in some parts of Louisiana because he was Catholic and, of course, you know, heavily Catholic straight. And a lot of people that I talked to who were normally conservative, favored him because of his religion down here, which, you know, hurt him in other southern states, of course.
Well, race was an issue then. It is now. When you were on the show last time, you were followed by Dr. Lauren Scott, and a guy who actually writes to you on occasion. But he said your remarks about race were, I think, absurd. Wasn't that the word he used?
Yeah, but he said he loved me, so that's. I mean, that's nice. So.
Some would say any act of love is an absurdity. but Dr. Scott disagreed with you when you said that some of the aversion to President Obama's related to race.
I stand by that. I mean, that's what I've observed. I mean, it's obviously not all of it, but I think a great deal of it's a lot of code words, you know, take back America, you know, take it back from whom? Who has it? Yeah. So I think you get a lot of that, and nobody's going to admit it outright. It's saying, I mean, just the word segregationist now is so quaint, which is kind of nice.
We'll return with Smiley Gray Anders, 297-5633, your number, back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A bit more time with Smiley Gray Anders, Jr., columnist for the Baton Rouge Advocate. His work is in the Advocate today, as it is almost every day, Monday through Saturday. And front page of the Metro section, 1B, 2975633. Smiley is 76 years young today. What are you going to do tonight with Lady Catherine?
Yes, Mrs. Anders is taking me out to a Vietnamese restaurant that I've tried and she hasn't. So we're going out there. My daughter took me out last night, so to a Mexican restaurant. So I've been having international cuisine day.
That's definitely a diverse choice of eateries for Smiley Anders. Last few days, we've had some real bright lights of our community die. Edmund Reggie. Leo Honeycutt will be speaking Friday at the West Baton Rouge Museum. And John Kennedy, the aforementioned president, opened his 1960 campaign in Louisiana, actually in 59, in Crowley with Edmund Reggie and Edwin Edwards at his side. Imagine that.
Yeah, I saw a photo from that somebody put on Facebook, and Kennedy was wearing a hat made out of rice or rice stalks or something. The first time, the only time I've ever seen him with a hat on, you know, he did not like to wear hats.
He did not like to wear hats, and I don't think he wore one in Texas when they asked him to put on a 10-gallon hat.
He did. At that time, he had a hat, an ugly thing, made out of rice stalks, I guess. I don't know.
T.J. Jemison, 95 years old. He will lie in state at the state capitol. He was a big part of this community.
He was
involved in some of the great battles for civil rights.
He really, he was staunch. Mm-hmm. He led his community for a long time.
And Joe Dean's funeral services today at 11 o'clock, First United Methodist Church. Yeah. 83 years for Robert Joe Dean Sr., Mr. Strang Music.
Strang Music.
You're smiling. Now, he was a character.
Funny guy. He really was. I've heard him speak a few times at Roche for different guys. And man, you didn't want to have Joe Roche. He was brutal. He was so funny.
Charles on North Foster. Hi, Charles. You're on with Smiley.
Good morning, gentlemen. I was wondering, Smiley, could you tell us what was the reaction at LSU when the president was killed? And also, could you elaborate a little bit on the origin of the Fighting Tigers? I did some research on that, and I find it really interesting.
I wasn't in LSU when the president was killed. I assume it was the same shock as everybody else felt, but I was working at that time. The Fighting Tigers, I think, as I recall, came from a Civil War unit, a Zouave unit from Louisiana that had fought in the war, wore outlandish costumes, as I recall the pictures, and were called the Tigers. Now, there may be another explanation, but that was what I had heard.
Well, you think of some of the stuff that went on in LSU's heyday under Paul Dietzel, who died a few months ago, and the Chinese bandits, and you had players dressed up looking like Oriental guys. You wouldn't, they were in Sports Illustrated.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that was a big deal.
Today, that would not be tolerated.
No, that's kind of like having a team named the Redskins. I mean, who...
Yeah, the Redskins issue is a significant one. But why do we have the Florida State Seminoles? Why do we have the Atlanta Braves, the Cleveland Indians, and why are the Redskins getting all the publicity?
Well, I think the objection is the word itself. I mean, if they were called, well, like although I don't like the Indians, the Northeast had to change. I don't know if they had to. But I think naming it after a tribe, or like the Chicago Blackhawks are named after an Indian, a chieftain who was named Blackhawk. And so I think that is not as objectionable as the skin thing, you know. And I think it'll eventually, down the road, it'll be changed at some point.
The owner says no.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the Marquette Warriors have changed their name. Yeah. The Stanford Cardinal.
Yeah.
They were the Stanford Indians. St. John's Redmen.
Yeah.
They're now the Red Flash.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So a lot of teams have switched names. But yeah. The Redskins, to this point, are not doing so.
Yeah.
But with all our problems in the world, how about the Raging Cajuns or the Fighting Irish? Where do we draw the line?
That's right. Well, I mean, how about Saints? I mean, you know, to an atheist,
that could be quite offensive.
Yeah, that's right.
Right.
That's right.
How about the New Orleans atheists?
Well, I like that.
You think that would fly?
Well, it's a short word. It would fit in the headline. Yeah.
Well, but anyway, Smiley, we're glad you're still going strong, and things are going well with the new management.
Yeah, it's fun. We've got some new guys in running things, and I think Mr. George is just having a ball with it. He's speaking everywhere. He spoke at Golden Deeds last week, and for the first time, he said it was. I see he spoke to a business group at LSU, and very frank about what the advocate's trying to do. You know, he's not, and I think he's enjoying the competition with the Picayune. I mean, the idea of a newspaper war is kind of exciting,
Here's a comment from Wade at Louis saying, "Tell Smiley I apologize for almost running a red light in front of him this morning downtown."
Because I gave him a really dirty look. I'm sorry.
Okay, and Gus, University Acres. Hi, Gus, you're on with Smiley.
Smiley, this is Gus Kinchin.
Hey, Gus.
A voice out of the past. Hey, listen, I wondered why you were so special. I love all your wit in the paper, but I discovered this morning that your birthday is the same birthday as my wife, Tony.
Tony's? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
She was the prettiest.
We had another connection that we just didn't even know about.
She was the prettiest girl at LSU when I was out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, she still is.
Tony Whittington, right?
That's right. That's right.
Man, yes. Beautiful girl.
And Gus.
She's been 52 years.
Gus
well,
has quite a history.
Birthday.
Quite a history at LSU. When did you and Gus first connect?
Gus was a Baton Rouge High guy. So I rooted against him, of course, a year.
Yeah.
And then he was, you were in the, he went to the Methodist Church, I believe, and used to go there for youth nights, and I'd see him there. And then, of course, LSU. She's a great, great player, great family.
And Todd and
football players, yeah.
A couple of strong players were sired by Mr.
Absolutely. It was kind of
Gus
the Archie
Kinchin.
Manning of Baton Rouge.
You're right. Brian Kinchin was a guy who became a good writer as well about his time as a footballer. Gus, thanks for calling today.
Hey, thanks. Good luck to y'all.
All right. Thank
Appreciate
you, Gus.
It. Appreciate it. Probably ran into Gus down at the old Paramount in the Heart. What was the other one? The Gordon,
yeah, the three downtown ones.
There were, when I was a kid in Little Rock, there were three downtown theaters.
Yeah.
No longer there. There was the Center, the Arkansas, and the Capitol. I will bet you there were three downtown theaters in Natchez, Mississippi.
There were two, and then we got a newer one, like in about the 60s, I guess. We had the Ritz, the Baker Grand, and then the Clark came in a little bit later. But, yeah, the Ritz was where I saw the cowboy movies.
I miss those one-screen theaters.
Oh, yeah.
I think the only one left in Louisiana is the Britannia. I think that's it.
Yeah, I've been there before when Kathy lived in New Orleans. Yeah. We used to go.
Well, you and Lady Catherine have fun tonight with your Vietnamese cuisine.
Absolutely.
We'll see you soon. Take care, Smiley. Now we're joined by Dr. Sheldon Gottlieb. He is a Jewish activist, a man who was born in 1932 in New York City. He lived through the Holocaust, graduate of University of Texas, doctorate in physiology. And for 50 years, he's been fighting anti-Semitism, and now he's displeased with our former president, George W. Bush. Before we get to that, good morning, Dr. Gottlieb.
Good morning, Jim. Thank you so much for inviting me to be on your program.
Well, nice to talk with you. And, you know, we were just talking to a gentleman born in 1937, and you were born in 32 in New York City, and I think context is important. I would imagine along the way you faced some anti-Semitism in this great land of ours.
Unfortunately, that's very true. But I don't like to dwell on that. I prefer the activities that help fight hatred wherever I find it.
Well, you lived through the Holocaust.
I find it. So I really, the anti-Semitism I encountered only reinforced my efforts to continue to fight unwarranted hate, group hates, etc.
Well, last week, President George W. Bush, the 43rd American president, who's kept a relatively low profile, granted the Messianic Jews showing. The Messianic Jewish Bible Institute in Dallas had advertised the former president as its keynote speaker at its annual fundraiser, prominently featuring the former president's appearance on its website. The Messianic Jews, embraced Jesus as the Messiah, but hewed to Jewish traditions, observing Jewish holidays and reciting Hebrew prayers and services. So what is offensive about President Bush addressing this group?
Jim, you have to go through a history of the Jewish people and understand exactly what conversion is. When they start preaching conversion, and if you look back at Jewish history, you'll find it always ended up with Jews getting killed. And because there is an intense belief within Christianity, and just let's leave this with Christianity right now. I don't want to get into Islam. But in Christianity, there is the intense belief that they have the truth, the sole truth, and nothing but the truth, and everybody else is wrong. Well, that's fine. This is the United States of America. People can believe whatever they want to believe. But what they believe is not necessarily true. And if they want to believe that and live by themselves and practice that, that's fine. But when they start going out and try to impose those beliefs on others, and it leads to the death of people, it leads to their suffering, intense suffering, it leads to the abscension of their possessions, it leads to rape, murder, the pogroms in Europe. What? Tell me, what is not offensive about it? How could you not say it's offensive?
Well, President Bush, Dr. Gottlieb, campaigned in 2000 and was quoted. I remember having a discussion about this when I was doing a statewide talk show in 2000. He said that nobody but Christians can go to heaven. This is nothing new for him. He hasn't changed his stripes. Why was he supported largely by the Jewish community?
The question is, why? Because he's appealing to a certain group of people for votes. He was appealing to his base for votes, and that's what he was doing. Now, he may fervently believe that, for all I know. That's fine. But he was appealing for votes. You told me he said that while he was campaigning.
He did.
Well, politicians say all sorts of things on campaigns. And Bush knows how offensive this is. So the question arose, why would he lend his name, and more than his name, the majesty of the office of the presidency, to such an undertaking that is divisive, that is socially abhorrent, and that leads to discrimination and hate?
The point I was going to make,
I don't know why. That you'd have to
Bush. You're fired up. That's great, but hold on just a moment. The point I was making is that President Bush got probably more percentage of the vote from Jewish voters than any Republican of any time, and he was supported by people like my friend Rabbi Weinstein, who thought his stance on Israel was superior to his opponents, and as a result of that, he got a lot of votes from Jewish Americans. But now he's no doubt he's advocating converting Jews to Jesus, and you're finding that offensive. So, in the
No. Jim, you're conflating different concepts. One, Jews voted for Bush in larger numbers than they usually do for the Republican Party, only because they felt that he was going to be stronger on defending Israel. That's all. It had nothing to do with his religious beliefs. What you're saying...
Well, no, I agree with that.
Do,
go ahead.
What you're attempting to do, Jim, let me finish, please, is conflate the two and make the... And you're making a leap of faith in people's minds that the Jews voted for him because of his religious beliefs.
No, I'm not doing that. You're putting words in my mouth, and you shouldn't do that, Dr. Gottlieb. I'm just saying that he got a larger percentage than most Republicans do running for president, primarily because of his stand on Israel, and now he's doing something that some of those people who supported him might find offensive. Is that fair?
That's right. They find it offensive because it has nothing to do now with the survival of Israel, but it has everything to do with the survival of the Jewish people. Because every attempt at conversion down through the years led to the death of Jews. Apparently you're not familiar with the history of the Jewish people in Europe to understand the role of religious disputations and the movements that they had led to. You know, in Europe there were three massive movements against the Jewish people over time. You know, the first was that the Jewish people would have to convert because the Christians claimed there was a Jewish problem. There was no Jewish problem, but the Christians said they had to convert. And when that failed, they said they have to then be expunged from the community. They were expelled from one community after another. And then when that failed, the third was they have to be annihilated. And we saw that in the Holocaust. My God, Jim, the whole history of Christianity. Have you ever read the book, The War of the Popes Against the Jews?
No, I haven't read that, Dr. Gottlieb.
Well, absolutely.
But I'm asking you the questions. Did you support President Bush?
This is.
Did you support President Bush in either of his quests for the White House?
No.
Okay, so...
No, but there were other reasons for that. But actually, I didn't like the way he was bringing religion and government together, because I am a very strong supporter of the concept of the separation of church and state.
Okay, hold tight. Don't go anywhere. We want to continue the conversation with Dr. Sheldon Gottlieb for a few more moments. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, it's 877-217-5757. Back after this 90-second pause on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. A few more minutes with Dr. Sheldon Gottlieb, a Jewish activist for a half century who lived through anti-Semitism in New York City as a young man, born there in 1932. Now lives in Boynton Beach, Florida, and he's upset with former President George W. Bush for appearing before a group last week, the Messianic Jewish Bible Institute, a group that embraces Jews or Jesus as the Messiah. Ryan and Gonzalez. Ryan, you're on the air with Dr. Gottlieb.
Hey, I guess the way I look at it is, you know, United States support of Israel is religious in nature. I mean, it's, you know, we don't say much about them going into Palestine and building and, you know, putting up tenement housing and the same thing that he's talking about, kicking out other people out of their homes. It is religious in nature. We back them because we have Judeo-Christian background. I don't understand, I guess, you know, what's the problem with talking to a bunch of Jews who perhaps want to change their religious views?
Dr. Gottlieb?
Jim, I had great difficulty in hearing him. His what he was saying came through so dim on my telephone.
All right. Well, then I'll try to summarize what he said. And he said that what's the problem with the president addressing a group of this kind? That I think he was saying it shows
into the microphone.
I'm speaking into the microphone. What's the problem, Brian and Gonzalez asked, with President Bush addressing a group that that is of an origin that believes Jesus is the Messiah?
There is no problem with that. What the gentleman seems to misunderstand, this is the United States. People are free to express whatever views they want to express. However, President Bush is not just any man. He is the former president of the United States. He not only represents himself, but he represents the majesty of an office that represents all the people of the United States, not just one group. Now, if he wants to do that, then they give him all this press, and he expresses his views. If just as he has the right to say whatever it is he wants to say, we have a right to respond to what he's doing. We have a right to express our views, and we find that what he is saying and doing, to be considering who he was and who he is, to be offensive.
All right, Corey at LSU. Corey, you're on with Dr. Gottlieb.
Thank you, Mr. Inkster. Would you ask
your voices are not coming through?
Go ahead, Corey.
The Jewish people are the chosen people of God.
Repeat that, please.
If you may ask the doctor, please, that he believes or he does not believe that the Jewish people are the chosen people of God.
All right, he asked if you believe that Jews are the chosen, God's chosen people.
You know, there has been so much misunderstanding of what that concept, the chosen people, mean. When he's saying this, I'm not sure why he's asking the question, and it sounds like he has another agenda. And I would like to know exactly what he means by it, because there is a very specific meaning amongst the Jewish people down through the ages as to what that concept means. Christians have distorted that meaning as a basis for killing Jews. So what does this gentleman mean?
Well, I can't read his mind, but I did get
another.
Well,
neither can I.
Well, you're trying to.
That's why I'm asking.
Well, he's
gone. I am asking.
He's gone, but he asked you if you believe that Jews are God's chosen
what
people.
What I believe has no bearing on this subject.
Dan, Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Dr. Gottlieb. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Should Jimmy Carter have refrained from expressing his opinion that the U.S. policy favors Israel to the disfavor of Palestinian or Arab countries in general?
Did you hear Dan?
No.
Okay, Dan.
I did not hear
all right. Well, then I will pose Dan's inquiry to you, Dr. Gottlieb. He says, did President Carter err by saying that the U.S. Policy favors Jews to the exclusion of policies that would be favorable to Palestinians and others in that region?
Jimmy Carter is a citizen of the United States, and he has a right to say whatever he wants. And as ex-president of the United States, he has an idea of what went on. But let us remember what Carter did. Now, whether he's right or wrong may depend on one's political views and how you wish to view the world and what's behind it. But remember what Jimmy Carter and Zbigniew Brzezinski did back in the 1970s. They helped create a Palestinian entity and give it credence to the point where Brzezinski even said, we have provided the Palestinians with their Balfour Declaration.
All right. Well, we've got to roll, Dr. Gottlieb, but thank you for your time. And we appreciate your remarks, and we've got some folks who are lined up to talk with you, so perhaps we can resume this conversation at some point down the line.
Whenever you want.
Thank you, sir. Nice to talk with you today.
Okay, bye.
Bye. We're visiting now with Denise Bode. She is a nationally recognized energy policy expert and a former corporate commissioner of the state of Oklahoma. She will be featured today as part of the Smart Growth Summit at the Manship Theater, and she is part of a boom without bust, breaking the cycle to encourage long-term prosperity and opportunity. This panel, which includes several other luminaries and will be moderated by Jeff Zender, includes Denise Bode, who is now a principal of Cornerstone Government Affairs. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us about your background and how this applies to the topic that will be discussed today.
Thanks so much for the opportunity. I've spent 30 years in the energy space, starting when I worked for Governor David Boren of Oklahoma back in the late 70s, have also been head of the Independent Petroleum Association, president of the Independent Petroleum Association of America, an elected official, the Corporation Commission, regulating oil and natural gas for 10 years, and have spent a tremendous amount of time in private practice as well, working in oil and gas issues. So 30 years, I've lived through the boom and bust cycles of the oil mm-hmm. and the natural gas industry, and I think we it can probably be best expressed by a bumper sticker that was out the last time we had one of these major oil and natural gas booms, which it said, basically, Lord, just give me another boom, and this time I won't mess it up. And so that's what we're going to talk about, is like with this an amazing boom, gas and oil from the shale formations that people say, you know, have lifespans of 100 years, that it's gotten particularly the newer folks in the industry believe that, well, it will be here forever. And as we all know, all resources are finite. So the idea is, how can we take this valuable resource that we have, add value to it, and then allow it to use those resources to make a more sustainable economic climate, both here in Louisiana, which is really the downstream part of the industry where the refining and chemical facilities are, as well as upstream where the production is in all these amazing new shale rock formations that they're producing from.
Well, the prelude to the discussion notes that over $100 billion in announced projects are slated for Louisiana in the next few years, and that consideration is warranted to ensure that our state and our region reap lasting economic benefits rather than short-sighted payoffs. How is this accomplished?
Well, I think the idea is many states that have lived through the boom and bust have created rainy day funds. So as the mm-hmm. income and the revenue and the jobs are being created, they're also putting some aside. Another way that they're doing it is also diversifying the resource, so that you're not only building these new facilities or upgrading new facilities to convert oil and natural gas into products that can be used in the chemical industry, converting the oil and natural gas into refined products that can be utilized, adding value to it year. Is here and now, and then utilizing that to grow manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing a real manufacturing renaissance in this country because we've got affordable energy, and so utilizing the energy to actually build a new manufacturing base is one of the ways that we can really add a lot of jobs and value if we focus on it.
We're visiting with Denise Bode. She will be featured today at the Smart Growth Summit in Baton Rouge at the Manship Theater. She's a nationally recognized expert on tax and energy policies, was the appointee to governor and then President George W. Bush's Energy Transition Advisory Team. You worked closely with the administration in Washington and also served 7 years as president of the Independent Petroleum Association of America. So you have a vast background in industry. And when it comes to smart growth, does industry sometimes get a bad name?
I think there tends to be a short-term focus, and there's not the planning that really needs to go on with communities. You know, in the United States today, it's a lot more urban than it was during the last boom, maybe 20, 30 years ago. And so planning and working with your local communities is something that really is important to make sure that you have sufficient infrastructure, for example, roads, because you carry this heavy equipment and trucks and stuff across roads. It has a tremendous impact on infrastructure that impacts everybody in the community, not just the industry. So working together with others in the planning community really is important. On the panel today, we're going to have several people, one of whom is Representative Vicki Steiner from North Dakota. And she not only is a state representative and has been working in the Bakken shale boom up there, where they've got man camps and tremendous amount of issues that they're dealing with, including infrastructure, pipelines, trains, trucks. She's dealing also with these issues in a very real basis and working from the county and the local government perspective with the industry so that they can do it smartly and they can avoid some of the issues that have happened in past booms and then busts.
What are the biggest obstacles?
I think the biggest obstacles are short-term thinking, the fact that there's not a lot of organization, so each company has sort of their own game plan that they want to go in, particularly in the exploration and production side. They want to kind of keep low-key, don't really want to tell people what they're doing because it's their business plan. They tend to be independent. So, and its very nature is, so trying to have the industry share and work more closely with local government, I think, is really important in the exploration production side. When you go downstream, where we are here in Louisiana and the Gulf states that have a lot of the chemical facilities and new refining facilities, then it's, okay, how do you grow these major facilities that utilize these products that are chemicals, maybe hazardous? How do you build those and integrate those new facilities into the community? How do you train the people that will be working in those facilities? And how do you make them sustainable, as efficient as possible, so that you can ensure that these facilities aren't going to just be there for the short term, that they're a long-term facility with jobs that have long-term impacts and in a positive way on a community.
So how did you view environmentalists when you were on the other side? And I guess, you know, you still in your own way represent industry. So are environmentalists bad people?
Oh, no. I think for those people, I always looked at it from the perspective of the energy industry, that the reason most people get into the industry is because they do have a love of the land. You know, they're, you know, people being trained as geologists and petroleum engineers. They're out in the field. They're people that, you know, embrace an environmental ethic. I think dealing sometimes with groups that are just anti-development is really what you tend to deal with mostly within the environmental organizations. And so it's really dealing with how you can work together to manage development in a wise way. It's not really that I think all of us feel like we have a strong environmental ethic.
Well, today the panel that Denise Bode will be involved with is at 12:15 at the Manship Theater as part of the Smart Growth Summit. She will be there along with some others, including Boo Thomas, who was with us a few days ago, the president and CEO of the Center for Planning Excellence, Dan Bornay, the president of the Louisiana Chemical Association. It'll be moderated by Jeff Zender, the chief executive officer of Zender Communications. What can be done what can be done in Baton Rouge that other places around the country have done that perhaps in the short term is something that is achievable here?
Well, I think, you know, providing leadership, the fact that CPEX is holding this discussion, I think this is the, as far as I know, Boo said that this is the first time they've really had an energy panel. And what we found is I've surveyed different companies and industry groups around the country is this is a discussion that hasn't really been had before. where you get community leaders and city planners and county planners and state planners together with the energy industry and say, how can we do this so that it has least negative impact on our community and also so but can add value and jobs in our community, and to have that discussion so that you plan for the long haul and don't just plan, you know, on the short term or on an ad hoc basis. So I think it's something where we can provide leadership through this discussion and expand this discussion to other areas of the country where they're needing these answers as well.
Well, thank you, Denise Bode. Good luck. Hope you enjoy your stay here, and we'll look for you today, 1215 Manship Theater. And for J.C. Cain, I'm Jim Engster. We thank you for listening. Back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.